Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover our new autumn collection with fresh designs and cosy colours. In-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello there and good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. It's John Cook with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. I hope you're very well after the weekend. It's 51551 if you want to get in touch with us, or 087-484-8888 on WhatsApp. You can let us know what's been happening where you are, or what's going on over the last few days. And why is Jim Gavin still staring at us from lampposts and polls nationwide, given that he's well and truly out of the contest? That's what one listener in touch has been asking me already today. And when will Fianna Fáil take down Jim Gavin's posters? They're Fianna Fáil failed candidate, unfortunately. It's 0818 715 815. If you have a problem with those posters, is it confusing? Does it matter? 51551 for your texts. And also today, miscarriage. It's an issue we do talk about now, but not enough. That's according to one listener who'll be telling us her story and raising some questions about the way women are treated after they experience the heartbreak of miscarriage later on in the programme. Liveline at rte.ie or 51551 for your texts, as I said, to let us know what's been happening to you over the weekend or whatever. Carmel, good afternoon.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm good, Carmel. What happened to you yesterday?
Well, I was on my way into the theatre where I was going into the technical rehearsal of the show we're working on. And I was in the north, I was passing through the north inner city of Dublin, and I heard a bang, a really loud bang, like a banger or a gunshot or a puncture. And I saw a cyclist, you know, one of those Just Eat delivery cyclists.
Yeah.
The front wheel of his bike seemed to jam, and he went somersaulting at great velocity through the air. And luckily there was, given the speed at which he came off and the almighty tumble he took, he landed in a tangle with his bicycle, but he didn't land on a car or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And
fell
to
the ground with a bang. It sounds shocking for you and for him, of course.
Well, I can imagine how he's feeling. But I was directly beside him, so I ran into him. And as I did, a young man converged ahead of me, and he had a couple of other people with him, kind of one to the side of me, one behind me. And he was playing the role of helper, but was quickly, I saw, not, was all his attention was going to the bicycle, the phone attached to the bicycle, and there was one of those kind of mounted grips, and watching the bag and all that while kind of making the noises about, oh, you come over here now, we look after you. So I was, kind of quickly, I had assumed there was a few of us going in to help, but it kind of quickly became apparent to me, to my instinct anyway, that this was a robbery. And also at that point, I was trying, like the man himself, these were all young men, the young man himself, the cyclist, he was completely, like he was having difficulty coordinating his body and kind of coming to himself,
mm-hmm.
but he was on his feet. But just was very uncoordinated, and he didn't make eye contact with anyone, because at this point now he's got a kind of a few people around him that mm-hmm. seemed to be, I suppose, if your instinct was telling you, well, look, and he was kind of reaching for his bike, and I was grabbing his bike off the other guy and trying to grab the, they also went for the back on his, the
okay.
bag on his back, but he did.
So hang on a minute, Carmel.
He had a bag around his chest as well.
Okay, just to be clear on this, so the food cyclist, delivery cyclist, he gets thrown in the air on his bike. He's down on the ground. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he was shocked and overwhelmed by what was going on, but you and others are in a crowd around him, all helping, you thought, but then you think some people are actually trying to rob him.
No, there was only, it was a small group. It was the people who had, I have no doubt, staged this, because there was no, his bike was able to move. And I cycled for years through Dublin when I used to live here. So that was engineered in some way, I don't know how, even if it was as simple as a banger that he gripped onto his brakes really hard suddenly, because he was flying along. and suddenly there was the bang and he was somersaulted.
Okay, well, it sounds very unfortunate anyway. I've no idea why it happened. And we heard on Friday's show about similar incident with bikes getting jammed in the road and all sorts of accidents happening for all sorts of reasons. But it's after it's happening. I'm trying to work out what do you mean by what you saw and in terms of a robbery?
What I saw was that this was a really well-coordinated effort to, one, get his bicycle, his phone, his bag, and another bit that really, really made my stomach sick with worry for what they had planned was to get him up away on his own. I presume because he had a bag strapped across his chest that would have been harder to get off him, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But that there was one pack leader, I would call him, and there were two others to the sides of me, not directly involved, but waiting and working off his cue because I could see the ricochet of glances and the kind of the dog language, to put it basically, you know, in terms of just the animal kind of primitive instincts in that go on in operations like this. And there seemed to be a couple of people on the other side of the street as well that were in some relation to that main guy as well, mm-hmm. that main predator in the situation. And I had just, because I got in at the same time, I just kept saying, I'm the mother here. I'm the mother here. I'm taking care of him because I'm a 55-year-old woman. And I tried to basically put myself, you know, at the top of that pack and go look for some decency, just looking for some decency and to try and stop them robbing him, basically.
And you were in no doubt, you felt something very untoward was going on here, Carmel. You were going to take control of the situation. How did they react when you said that to them?
Well, he got quite aggressive and was like, are you saying I'm a scumbag? And I just didn't engage in that. And I just kept saying, I'm mother here, I'm mother here. And at that one point he said, well, I'm the father figure. Now, this was a guy in his early 20s. And he's like, well, I'm the father figure. And he was quite, but all this, like, while these words were being spoken, he was trying to take the bike. I was grabbing the bike back off him. He was trying to take the phone off the bike to see would it come off, but it was well mounted. And he was also reaching for the bag the whole time. Uh-huh. So I didn't engage in his arguments. I just kept kind of trying to appeal to the sense of, like, you know, mother's taking charge here.
And you are not taking this man's bike, is what you're saying, or his bag, or his phone, or anything else. Were you on your own, Carmel?
Up a side street either. Yeah, I was on my own.
Were you intimidated yourself by this? It sounds like an intimidating experience.
I'll be honest, I was extremely, like, I was shaking like a leaf, but in the moment I had to hold my nerve and hold the strength because, you know, otherwise it was not going to go well. But I did feel, yeah, of course, I was absolutely frightened. And I had my own laptop in my bag, which I wouldn't normally have. And I was on my own and I was outnumbered. But I think I had in my favour the element of surprise and the element of being, I do think when you're a woman of a certain age, you're slightly less likely to get beaten up in a situation like that than a young man might be.
Well, I would hope so, Carmel, but I mean, there's no guarantee. You were putting your safety on the line there to help somebody else.
Well, I mean, sure, wouldn't I want somebody to do that for me? Because mm-hmm. I was trying to tend to this young man, and I still don't know. Like, I mean, he managed to wobble off, and I was literally just getting in their way while he mounted the bike. He was in a kind of a shocked stupor, but his instincts were supreme in that he avoided eye contact with anyone to not escalate it. And he also just kept trying to get onto his bike to get away. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So he had great instincts and I really feel for him. But his body was covered, so I couldn't see what kind of, you know, whether he would have been lacerated from the road because he came off at such velocity. But I saw when he was tumbling, he'd his head tucked under him. So I felt, okay, I can't see any injury on his head. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That he didn't seem to land on his head, thankfully. I mean, it could have gone horrifically for the man. He was mm-hmm. incredibly lucky that it wasn't any worse.
He's lucky you were there, I think, Carmel, as well. Were there other people around or did anyone come to your help or did they realise what was actually happening here?
There was very little traffic on. It was on the street itself where the traffic were flowing. There would have been plenty shoppers in the background. But if you think of it from their point of view, they've seen an accident and they see a few people already in beside this person as they're getting to the feet. So they wouldn't have known what was going on. But as I moved away, as I was kind of clearing a path for him to get away, I noticed that the other people on the side of the street that I looked for, kind of looked for a little bit of appeal. And then I saw very clearly they knew the main guy involved. And then I was like, OK, this is very staged here. You know what I mean? And at that point, as he was getting onto his bike, a Garda car was coming up behind me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if someone rang the police or if they happened to be patrolling, but a Garda car was coming as he'd already got onto his bike and was just trying to get away, mm-hmm. the cyclist. Mm-hmm.
You felt there was something definitely wrong going on here, and maybe you were glad to see the Gardaí then. Did you get to tell them?
Yeah, I told them in very brief. They weren't, you know, there wasn't, at that point, from their point of view, I would have been still concerned that someone maybe follow him to see had he a concussion. Was he going to start vomiting around the corner, fall off his bike? But they just said, well done to me, whatever, and took a glance at the people to the side. And kind of that was it. Like, I can't guess at what was going through their mind, but they looked like business as, you know, it didn't mm-hmm. look like anything new to them, that's
okay,
for sure.
OK, and we don't know what has happened afterwards, or maybe the Gardaí have followed up on this. And I hope they have, Carmel, as well. The injured party here carried on, as you said. You didn't really get to talk to him or to see how he was afterwards,
no.
did you? I'd say he was just
he
in fear of everyone around him by the sounds of things.
Well, he could have been, for all he knew, he might have had people literally fighting over the spoils of this, of his catastrophe. I mean, I wouldn't think so, because I was really fighting for him with everything I had, you know, in terms of my intent. But like, because, I mean, you know yourself, if you've gone through something like that, it's one thing and you discover you're relatively uninjured, but it'd be a fright to be left without your livelihood, without all your belongings. And who knows what was going to happen if they got him off the way they wanted to get him off, mm-hmm. which, you know, I don't know what that was about, but that seemed quite sinister to me. But I think I was very lucky that I think because I was going into a theatre rehearsal and I was ready to deal with problems, I just was lucky enough to be kind of reactive enough, you know, because it happened so fast.
Okay.
He'd have been gone off that street with them within 20 seconds otherwise. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Well, thankfully you stepped in, Carmel, and thankfully you were there to come to his aid. I hope he's doing okay today, as I'm sure you do as well. We don't know. We presume he's gone back to work, but it certainly is a difficult situation he was in that could have been worse, as you said. 51551, if listeners want to get in touch on this as well. Carmel, are you always so brave? Do you always step in to... Are you one of those good Samaritans who always steps in to help there? Because not everybody does nowadays. Some people just keep on going.
You know, I think sometimes I'm like everyone else. I have my good days and my bad days. Some days I'm a bit caught up in my own thoughts, perhaps. But generally speaking, I think I really learned a lot. In London, I was working on a play in London, and when I was there, I was walking the streets every night. And my mother had died, you know, previous to that, and I spent a lot of time with dogs in a pack, and I think I'd learned an awful lot about the kind of primitive side of our nature through being out with dogs in a pack.
Really?
And I kind of learned some very simple things, like what I was doing. I was playing the role that the kind of main dog in a pack would be usually an older female. That's why I kept saying, I'm mother here. I'm mother here. It's usually an older female in a dog pack or a horse pack, and they'll be the one to try and get in between the kind of predator and the prey. Mm-hmm. And so I'll do my best, you know what I mean? I'll do my best. And I do think when I'm kind of, I suppose, the animal in me is most alive and most brave when I'm in the middle of having to step up for mm-hmm. something. And at the moment, because I'm directing, I had to step up. I knew I was going to have to step up last night, but I didn't know I was going to have to step up on the street. But sure, look, if we're going to step up, for fiction, we should step up for life, shouldn't we?
Well, you saw something wrong, Carmel. That's what you felt. You saw something wrong, and this is not okay, and you were not going to let it happen.
No, I couldn't believe the rage in me towards the injustice. Just the absolute, I felt like I'd have gone through, like I was not tempted to turn away for one second. In fact, I was just wanted to follow it all the way to make sure he was 100% mm-hmm. okay. Mm-hmm. And I'd have loved to have actually reasoned with that young man who was the pack leader. I'd have loved to reason with him that he would engineer a situation where someone could have been killed for what? A couple of hundred euro of a loot? Like,
well, we don't know
humanity.
Yeah, we don't know what could have happened there. And then sometimes you can't reason in some situations as well. But fair play to you, Carmel. We have listeners getting in touch to say you're some woman. Fair play to you for stepping in and looking after this young man in his hour of need and taking on the pack, as you said, and saying, not today, mate, not today.
Yeah, and that's the power we have as women of a certain age, really. Like, I don't have kids myself, but I'll play mother where mother is required.
Well, that's a great instinct. And it was a great instinct to that young man yesterday that you came to his help as well. Were you nervous afterwards? Were you shaken heading back home yourself after the theatre last night?
Well, no, I went directly into rehearsals and I just harnessed the energy and just focused it. But then when I was walking home, I was like, no, I'm not. I am not going into fear in the streets here. The streets belong to all of us. It's our world. We can't give it up to people who are, you know, really practicing the worst of human nature.
Well said, Carmel. Is this a play you've written yourself?
Yeah, it's called Cuckoo Time. And ironically, some of the themes are similar to what was happening.
I was just going to say, you're getting me excited now. This sounds like a thriller, Carmel.
Well, it's more that there's a question about the motives of a woman of 60 in the play who's, we wonder, you know, she befriends a man with dementia and she's kind of wild and she's homeless. And there's a question in the play as to whether she's out to exploit him or to help him, or whether this relationship will bring out the best in her or the worst in her.
Well, we won't get you to give away the ending just yet, Carmel. Where's the play on? Cuckoo Time.
It's on in Glass Mask Theatre in Dawson Street in Dublin. So that's where I'm going in now again to do our dress rehearsal.
Uh-huh. And when can people see it?
We have our first preview tomorrow night and then it runs for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Break a leg, as they say, Carmel. Thank you very much for talking to us today. And thank you very much for standing up for that man. And as you said, taking back those streets. You were looking out for him yesterday and looking out for us all, I think. So well done, Carmel. And continued success to you.
Thank you. And I really want to just encourage everybody out there to really let themselves be brave. Be brave and just do our best. Mm-hmm. But thanks so much. Thanks so much for talking.
Carmel,
thank you. I really wish that man the very best.
Oh, we all send him the very best. And the best to you as well, Carmel. Thank you very much. And Cuckoo Time at the Glass Mask Theatre, if you want to find out more about it as well. That's an aside. Carmel was not ringing to plug her play at all. She's modest with it, I think. But by God, was she through some drama yesterday evening that she stepped up and did a great favour for a young man and for us all, I think. 51551 if you want to get in touch, or liveline at rte.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
And 51551 for your texts, or 087 484 8888 by WhatsApp. It's John Cook with you until 3. Peter, hello there.
Hello, Sean. How are you?
John. How are you?
I'm fine.
You were out over the weekend. Or were you out driving yesterday?
Yes, I was. Yes. I've travelled in and out from Tullamore in County Offaly on several occasions over the last week or so. Mm-hmm. And I see lots of posters of Jim Gavin on the telegraph poles and situated around the catchment area of Tullamore. And yesterday I went for a Sunday drive, which brought me to Mullingar, Longford, up actually to Mohill and around that area as well. And
on the way
up and on the way back, they were scattered on various poles as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering. Do people realise that he's not on the presidential election race anymore? And why are they up on it?
He's on the ballot paper.
I understand that. Yeah, but I have my own ideas in relation to why he's on the ballot paper. But It could be a ploy in relation to getting people to vote the way they normally would vote when they're voting, say, for coalition partners.
Well, he's on the ballot paper because he was a declared candidate by the deadline for the presidential election and apparently can't be taken off it. You think that might play into the hands of some of the bigger parties?
Well, that's my opinion, because if I was just going to vote and I seen his name on the ballot paper and then I seen the other candidates on it as well. And if I had a sort of supportive idea of supporting, say a coalition of various parties, then I would be inclined to give 1, 2, and 3 to the various candidates. So I think that's very unfair in relation to the other candidates.
Well,
on the ballot.
That's a theory in an unusual election. Your theory, of course, Peter, but it is the case that he's on the ballot paper because he couldn't be removed from it. What's going to happen come voting day? Well, that remains to be seen as well. You're surprised, though, to see him still up the polls or on the lampposts or all around the country?
Yes, I'm just wondering why the local Cummins for the party that supports Jim Gavin are not out taking them down because they were quick enough to put them up. Mm-hmm. And I have no allegiance to any political party whatsoever. I normally vote in relation to policies and irrespective of what party are putting them out.
Well, Jim Gavin has made it very clear he's pulled out of the presidential campaign. You see no reason then why the poster shouldn't be pulled down, Peter?
No reason whatsoever. And perhaps Jim Gavin might speak to his supporting political party. Uh-huh.
Well, it's a matter for Fianna Fáil. And actually, we here at Liveline have asked Fianna Fáil what's happening to remove these posters of Jim Gavin. How many have been removed to date? When are they aiming to have them down by? Will they be down before voting day? And I'm told we have a response simply from Fianna Fáil to say they are in the process of removing these posters of Jim Gavin. But people like Peter and others are now seeing them all over the place still. Betty, good afternoon. 51551 if you want to get in touch, by the way. How are you, Betty?
I'm in right order here, John. I'm up on Ford Mountain here taking in a bit of nice South East Ireland fresh air.
Sounds lovely.
And not a poster in sight, John. Not on the mountain, anyway.
Not a care in the world, I think, Betty. Are you relaxed?
I'm very relaxed. Oh, God, yeah. The old lungs are not so relaxed. But, hey, mm-hmm. Lovely up here. Yeah,
okay.
Lovely,
well,
it sounds good.
Have you been out walking or getting your steps in?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. You have to walk to get to the top of this mountain because you're not able to drive up here, so you have to get out Shanksmere, as they call it, and just shake a leg and get up there.
That's
but
the
anyway,
best way, and you're feeling better for it as well.
Oh, yes, it's brilliant. We're so lucky here to have this trail.
Now, Camira, are you even climbing mountains these days to check that nobody is putting up posters in your area? Because so militant are you. You will not put an election poster in my lamppost there. Is that it?
Well, we're very lucky here in Kilrown, Rosslare Harbour. We have actually managed to become an election poster-free zone. Now, we did have one candidate who put posters up, but the party came back and removed them for us.
So were they Jim Gavin posters?
I could say at this stage they are, yeah. Because he's out of the race, I don't mind saying it at this stage. But luckily we had James Brown in the area and James had them removed.
So you had a rule in force, no posters, please, in our community, as you've done in previous elections, I think.
Yeah, we contact all the candidates before the elections and we asked them very respectfully not to post any posters within our village limits and they all respect us. So we've managed to be fairly successful last year and this year. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Until all those Jim Gavin posters went up. Were there many of them?
Well, I was driving from Rosslare Harbour to Tenaheely yesterday up to the Vintage Day and we happened on quite a few Jim Gavin posters. More, I'd say there was more Jim Gavin than any of the other candidates.
And were you surprised
and
by that, Betty?
I'm surprised that they're still there.
Were you surprised by that?
Yes,
there seems to be so many there?
Yeah, I just think that like he's Fianna Fáil's representative and I would have thought that Fianna Fáil would have taken it upon themselves in the interests of their reputation to have them removed, mm-hmm. seeing that he's not a candidate anymore.
Well, we're told from Fianna Fáil they're in the process of removing them. They got them down fairly quickly when you said, sorry lads, no posters here.
Yeah. We're lucky that James Brown rang me pretty much straight away when the posters were still there a few days later and he had somebody out here and removed them within hours.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was just a mistake then or an oversight?
Well, we had tried to contact Mr. Gavin and he contacted us the following day. His secretary or his election committee or whatever contacted us after, I suppose, about 4 or 5 days after the poster went up. But he was ignoring us up to then. But Fianna Fáil made sure that they were taken down. Mm-hmm. And then the following day, Jim Gavin's company contacted us to say that they'll remove them in the next few days. So I said, you're too late. James Brown has looked after it.
Okay.
He has removed them.
Job done. And do you think you're any better off without the posters there, Betty? I know you don't like them from a visual point of view. I know you don't like them from an environmental point of view. Do you think people will still be very aware there is an election going on here and they do need to get out and vote next Friday week?
Well, I'd say if they didn't see the amount of posters that were up all over the country, I think it's Specsavers that need to go to. But like I'm part of the environmental group here in Rosslare Harbour. And it's part of our policy to try and do things as sustainably as we can. But what I would love to see is a national campaign to ban these election posters or to come up with another strategy where maybe one big poster with all the candidates on it or a document delivered to every house in Ireland by the government with all the candidates on the document. A recyclable little booklet. Wouldn't that make more sense?
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that
rather than all this plastic.
Yeah, it's interesting. You seem to be having success that candidates and parties respect your views. It might be one that catches on so, Betty, elsewhere.
Hopefully it will, John. Yeah. Yeah, that's my dream that we'll become an election poster free country.
Okay.
And cut down on this one soft plastic.
Now I let you back to dreaming about bigger and better things as you're admiring the views there after your climb there.
All right, John. Thanks,
Betty, enjoy your afternoon. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
And 51551 for your texts as well, about all sorts of things, as we found out on the programme last week and as we've been talking about. It's all up for discussion here. And particularly I'm interested to hear your thoughts on miscarriage. It's an issue we do talk about nowadays, but not enough. It's something that struck me by Claire Moriarty, who joins me next. You were writing in the Irish Times about it, Claire. How are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for talking to us as well. Because while we can talk about miscarriage nowadays and should talk about miscarriage nowadays, you still say it's obviously very difficult and we don't do it enough, you feel.
I don't know. It's complicated. I think it's really good for some people to talk about it. Some people prefer not to. But I think probably the public discourse on it, both at the level of what we could do to improve people's experience of it, mm-hmm. And sort of that could do to be spoken about a lot more and by the sort of various people who could help with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you're right, it's a private issue for every mum and dad and families out there as well, so we respect that too, but it can help for others to talk about it as well. It's 51551 or 0874848888 if people want to get in touch with us. Claire, can I ask you about your experience of miscarriage, please?
Sure. I'm sure everybody feels very differently about their own experience, but I think though nothing is normal, mine may have been reasonably routine in various ways, at least statistically. So I'm in my 30s, so I had an early scan after I found out I was pregnant at about 8 or 9 weeks. I heard a heartbeat at that, and then there was some funny issue with the dating, so they said to come back in 2 weeks, and then everything seemed fine, heard the heartbeat again, went in for what's called the booking appointment, which is the kind of first main appointment you would have in the hospital as part of a public pregnancy. And when I had my scan or my sonogram there, they just couldn't find a heartbeat then. So what happens then usually is you sort of go upstairs and have a more detailed scan and they confirm the loss for you. And then you start to make various decisions about what you want to do.
Can you remember that feeling, Claire, or the worry, the build up, because you're hoping for something very positive and things change very quickly?
What's strange is, and again, this is probably a feature of what I was saying a moment ago about the need for communication at some levels on it. It hadn't entered my mind it was possible for me. You know, I think as far as I know, early miscarriage can be up to 1 in 4 pregnancies can end that way. So it hadn't occurred to me at all, even despite this kind of funny issues with the dates earlier in the pregnancy, that it could happen. So it was probably shock. And then trying to make decisions about how to move forward. So I decided I wanted surgery as soon as possible and went in and got it. But as I was writing about in the Irish Times, there were various parts of my experience of going in for that I thought could have been handled a lot better. And since I've written about it a few times, I get a lot of communications from people who've had very similar experiences across the whole swathe of hospitals, and people writing about their experience 30 years ago, and now that was much worse, it seems like. But lots of people writing about experiences all over the place that have shared a lot of the features of mine.
Mm-hmm. Were you on your own, Claire?
I was, and it probably would sound strange to admit it, but because I'd had my previous daughter under COVID, I become sort of accustomed to doing everything on my own, because that was what was sort of mandated in those pregnancy experiences. So when I was told to come in for the surgery, it didn't actually even occur to me to ask, could I bring my husband? Because I just assumed I'd be going on my own. And I'm sure lots of people would listen to that and think that's mad how you could mm-hmm. even forget to ask or make that kind of assumption. But yeah, it didn't occur to me that he could be with me.
Well, it's understandable, I suppose. We went through a stage where you were lucky to be able to go anywhere for a while. So if you had to do it on your own, you had to, albeit that was hard for lots of people going through pregnancy and for their partners as well, missing out too. But it's why you say that you were on your own. And I'm just thinking that's a lot to take in, that being given bad news when you're on your own as well.
Yes, and it's hard to even recall details as well. So there's kind of the emotional side of it, and then there's just the kind of pragmatic health stuff around. It's really important you remember the details of instructions from doctors and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's definitely a downside of it.
So what happens, Claire? You were sent home but with an appointment to come back. Is that what happens?
Well, no, and again, I don't know if I was just a bit unlucky, but you're sent home with the promise to be contacted the next day about an appointment, and they do a bit of warning you that it might be. So I think I had this experience on a Tuesday of finding out, and then was lucky to, or was at least made feel I was lucky to get the surgery on the Friday. But they had been indicating it could be as long as next week. And though I feel my emotional response to my miscarriage overall has been, I've been quite fortunate to not, I don't think, be hit as hard by it as I might have been. I found the idea of having to wait until the following week extremely mm-hmm. distressing, I have to say. I thought the idea of knowing, you know, this pregnancy I wanted was in there, no longer living, I found the idea of carrying that around in my body pretty upsetting. So mm-hmm. I had to sort of ring around the hospital a bit the next day when I didn't hear from somebody by the time I thought I would hear. And again, I think it was, you know, the hospital was trying to do their best for me to get me in as soon as they could. But again, you're kind of ringing and you're having to say over and over again, you know, I received bad news yesterday. I need to talk to somebody about when I'm going to get my D&C surgery. So I think, you know, one of the pieces I was trying to get across in the article was that there's a great amount of compassion to be had in good systems. Like, I've never met anybody in any of my maternity experiences that I didn't think was a good advocate for women or a caring, compassionate, you know, talented healthcare provider. But some of the systems and the lack of space in the hospitals make it impossible for them to give you a really good experience, just because they don't have the separate admissions. They don't have separate suites for you. It's just you're sort of thrown in with what the state provides for them mm-hmm. to give us our care, you know.
And I'll come to that in a moment. But when you talk about systems, I mean, you came in for what you thought was a routine scan, and then you're waiting to see what comes up on that scan. How does it work then? You know, is there someone there to help you or talk you through the news that was not expected? Because otherwise you might have walked out there happily waiting for your next appointment. Were you treated any differently because that was not going to be the case?
Yeah, so they do. You have that initial sort of where they just rub the sort of monitor over your stomach and then they couldn't find the heartbeat. So they're giving you a kind of you know, first blush of bad news, let's say, but you're going to have to go upstairs to get it confirmed with a more robust scan. So you're already kind of at that point taken out of the main course of things that might lead you back to blood tests or whatever the next part of the experience would be. So then you go upstairs, at which point I would have called my partner to come in and come in for that second scan. Mm-hmm. And then you're kind of going to deliver it options. So for some people, they don't want to intervene, or they would like to just let things proceed normally and let their body handle it. And then for lots of people, they will want to have more of an intervention. So in my case, I think I just wanted to be pregnant again as soon as possible. So in my head, what was consistent with that was having a surgery as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. And is there someone to talk you through that carefully and to go through the feelings you might be having, the questions you might have?
I suppose the doctor who talks to you after the sort of the loss of the pregnancy has been confirmed will give you those options. And I suppose if you had questions, they would make themselves available, I'm sure, to answer them. But I think I had a pretty strong sense of what I wanted immediately.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you what you meant there where you were talking about the separate admissions, because this is when you came back to hospital. And while I'm sure that the staff in hospitals are very aware of how distressing miscarriage is, they are also busy, and there's often hospitals are limited in terms of staff and resources or space as well. What happened for you, Claire?
So the normal experience for people checking in for labour is that you go in the sort of front main doors of the public hospital, at least if you're in the public system, which I was, and then you sort of wait to be admitted and you do your kind of admissions paperwork and go into whatever part of the hospital that you're supposed to. And I don't know if my experience was unusual for some reason, but I was just told to sit and check in with all the women checking in to give birth. So people in various stages of contractions, people on the phone to partners, telling them to get to the hospital, it's happening or whatever. So there's kind of no separation, or at least there wasn't for me, between my checking in to have, you know, my last pregnancy removed from my body and people checking in to give birth or have cesareans or whatnot. So there's no kind of separate channel that keeps you away from being sort of put in alongside people who are going in to have to deliver live babies, you know.
Did you think there would be, Claire?
Yeah, I did assume so. I assumed that even if there wasn't a separate part of the hospital you'd be going to, they wouldn't make you sit alongside people who are about to have the experience you've just been told you can't have, you know?
Mm-hmm. And when you're there, so waiting for your surgery after miscarriage, and you're beside other women who are in various stages of labour or going in to have their babies, how does that feel then, Claire? It came as a shock to you, so how did you feel?
Well, it sort of feels like it's compounding a little bit by contrast, a sense of a loss. So you're sort of whimpering good luck at people as they leave the row of chairs, and then you're heading up to a different part of the hospital to have, you know, to have surgical removal. So I can see, and in what a lot of letters I've received from people or emails I've received, that people find this extremely distressing to have to begin their experience of miscarriage alongside people having the experience they were desperate to have, let's say.
And you sound very strong, Claire, but it must have been distressing too.
Yes, it's definitely upsetting. And, you know, but I do want to emphasise that I exceed, you know, every person I met with in there on the day. And I don't know, again, if this is a universal experience, and certainly some of the emails I've received would make me feel otherwise. But everyone was individually very nice. It just felt that there was a lot of ways that things could have been organised better. That would make it a bit more of a compassionate and sensitive experience. And then, you know, last week the Health Research Board released their sort of statement of findings of all the gaps in research around miscarriage and early pregnancy loss. So, you know, I suppose there's not enough research being done on it. The facilities are really difficult for it, and then we still don't have any policies around it, so you don't get miscarriage leave or anything like that after the experience. So there's just a lot that is lacking, you know.
But there you were, wishing people well as they went off to have their babies while you were waiting for something very distressing. Tell me about how that went, or afterwards how you felt, please.
Yeah, and again, I was on my own. It probably would have been better if I hadn't been on my own. But sort of shocked, I suppose. You sort of assume that there will be a slightly different experience to, you know, and then after the surgery, again, I think it was because there was construction happening in the hospital, but I think the person in the next room had a newborn baby, so you can hear the cries of a newborn. And again, that's not... It's nothing they can do if they don't have anywhere else to put you or that person. But you would think if a system was designed with any kind of sensitivity in mind, it wouldn't be good to have a person wake up from a procedure where they've just had a miscarriage removed alongside the newborn cries that would represent that broken hope, you know?
You were on your own, though, as you said, and I suppose very aware of what's just happened, and you hear those cries of a newborn baby when sadly that's not going to happen for you. It adds to the distress, obviously, Claire, and I suppose it's one that I think many people have had to go through. Can you describe how you feel there?
In lots of ways, I was very fortunate. You know, for lots of people who go through a miscarriage, the next thing is not a successful pregnancy. I mean, for me, it pretty much was. I had a baby a few months later, or I got pregnant again a few months later. And that was a very fortunate thing. But so especially, you know, in lots of ways, I'd had a very light, I only had one major miscarriage experience. I hadn't had one before this experience that I'm discussing now. But for lots of people who are having recurring miscarriages and that kind of thing, you could expect the trauma of that sort of experience to be very much compounded, you know?
It's 0818715815 if people want to get in touch, or 0874848888 on WhatsApp as well, because we're interested in your stories about this and allowing people to talk more about it if you want to talk about miscarriage as well. As you say, Claire, for people it can be a common occurrence, unfortunately, and this is something they have gone through many times. And as I mentioned to you as well, the hospitals do all seem to have policies of being careful and sensitive around people, but it might be down to staff resources, or it might be down to the building work, as you said, in the hospital down the hall, or a lack of space. Do you think we can plan better for this in future to improve the situation for other mums going through this?
Absolutely. I think if you look at the three things that I think would help, which is better research to understand what would benefit people going through this experience from all sorts of perspectives, whether it's just medical or what kind of communications are useful. We know we're not doing that research. You know, that report just came out last week to say it's not happening. So the first thing we could do is start doing that research and start funding it. The second thing is to try and, you know, bring in people who know about design, bring in people who know about systems, and try and make sure that even within the constraints we have now of the size or the age of the hospitals or the amount of resources available, that we're steering things towards a more compassionate way of doing things. And then the third thing is that, you know, there was this huge celebration earlier at the beginning of the summer, I think, when the UK brought in unpaid miscarriage leave. We've nothing here, no statutory leave for pregnancy loss. You're just told to go away with a medical note. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things we could be doing to make people's experience less difficult, and we're doing none of them. Mm-hmm. So, do you know what I mean? I think those three things seem really obvious. So miscarriage leave, you know, policy, better hospital and systems design, and more research.
Mm-hmm. Regarding the buildings, I suppose that all takes time and a lot of money, but we know we're working towards bigger and better hospitals all over the country and new maternity units, etc. You do write, I read with interest, I feel I can say with confidence there's a good reason you wouldn't have a wedding planner and an undertaker share a reception, much in the same way you wouldn't want to be checking in for your miscarriage surgery at the same time other women are checking in to have their babies. It could be a long way off before we see that, Claire.
I hope not. I think sometimes the problem is our history in Ireland, especially on these issues, especially if you think about Magdalen laundries, mother and baby homes, it's so bad, you know, even sort of 30, 40 years ago and much more recently, that we can, you know, we can tend to think we've come a million miles and we're doing great now because we're not, you know, locking people up and removing their babies and this kind of thing. But I really think we need to realise how bad that was and how we should be really trying to move as quickly as we can, as far away from that legacy as possible, and making sure that, you know, we're honouring those people who suffered under that system by looking after their grandchildren and their, you know, the sort of future women of the country. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think we need to put the foot on the pedal to help with this, especially in the context where we're constantly hearing complaints about the dropping fertility rate. If you want people to have more children, make it easier for them.
And make it easier in terms of the workplace as well, Claire. We hear about that a lot as well in terms of flexibility at work, and you've touched on it a few times as well. So I wanted to ask your experience when you had your miscarriage, when you come out of surgery, did you have to take time off? Was there people who were flexible or accommodating or understanding around you in the workplace or elsewhere?
I got the normal medical note from my doctor in there, which said 2 weeks at least. And so I sent this to my employer and I went back in. Just to flag, the UCC Pregnancy Loss Group have just released last week, I think, a workplace toolkit for dealing with pregnancy loss. So I'm sure that would be a very valuable resource to people. But yeah, it was. You go back to work and it's difficult because one of the most upsetting things I had was walking back into the office and just remembering how hopeful and how different my life felt leaving the office the previous time. So that stuff, there's a bit of jitters around going back. And then in terms of ongoing or sort of subsequent experiences of trying to get pregnant. For most people, they find out they're not pregnant when they desperately want to be pregnant by getting their period, you know. So if this happens to you in work, which it did to me in a few of the intervening months where I hadn't got pregnant again, you know, that's this sort of mini tragedy that happens to you, you know, in a cubicle in work. And then you sort of have to go back into the office and kind of sort of plough on as though nothing major has happened when, you know, for lots of people, especially mm-hmm. people who'd had more ongoing fertility issues than I had, and mm-hmm. That's, you know, a real tragedy. So I think flexibility on dealing with not just the aftermath of miscarriage, but how usually it's connected to probably a fraught continued fertility journey for a lot of people.
And Claire, just before we finish on this, I feel we've had lots of conversation and debate and political talk about there being leave for people going through miscarriage or fertility treatment as well. A long way to go there yet as well, it still seems, because it just isn't something that's available. It's still being talked about.
No, I believe there's been a draft bill since something like 2021 and it still keeps getting pushed back. So I think the moral case is obvious to me that it's it's not enough to just send people off with a medical note as though all that happened to them was something medical. Equally, the partners of people who've been trying to have babies for a long time deserve, you know, they're not going to get any good out of that medical note. They deserve to be considered as well. And even not quite apart from the ethical case, it's hard for me to understand the resistance to it, given that if people are entitled to a medical note anyway, is there even a major cost here to be worrying about?
Mm-hmm. Claire, thanks so much for speaking out about miscarriage and speaking so well about it too as well. Thanks very much, and I wish you and your family all the very best for the future. And to others listening out there, it's 51551 if you want to get in touch. It's 087-484-8888 and it's liveline@rte.ie.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818-715-815.
And 51551. Breach, hi.
Hi, how are you, John?
I'm very well. And yourself?
I'm great, thank you. I'm really good.
You enjoyed our chat with Carmel earlier on.
Oh, my goodness. I was doing stuff in my kitchen and actually preparing dinner, and I actually stopped to listen because she was amazing, wasn't she? So kind and decent and brave, but the decency of her just shone out off the radio.
Is it a story you could relate to, Breach? Would you step in a situation like that? Because I was saying a lot of people wouldn't. They'd be afraid or for themselves or busy with our own business and our own lives. But Carmel was saying, no, sometimes you just got to get in there and you've got to do what's right.
I absolutely agree. And like Carmel, I'm a middle-aged woman. I'm in my 50s. And I feel as I age, I get a little bit more brave, not a little less. And
good for you.
I will call out things when I see them. And why not? I mean, we have to remind people there's a lot of good and decent people out there. There's a small faction of thugs and whatever else you want to call them, but the majority of people are good. And sometimes we kind of allow, you know, certain elements of social media, or we just allow ourselves to believe that it's all dangerous everywhere. And now, look, I wouldn't walk down a place for the, you know, in the middle of the night on my own or something, but there's a lot of good, there's a lot of decency, and I see it all the time when I go about my day. I do a commute, I see great acts of kindness sometimes in the small things. It's the thousands of small things.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be huge, grand gestures, but it's giving each other a hand. Do you know, we're all just getting on with the day, aren't we, really?
Mm-hmm.
Every day brings it... Pardon?
Go on, Breach.
Sorry. Every day... Who knows what's happening on your Monday or my Monday? My Monday might be going great, but on one, you know, non-descriptive Monday, something might go wrong for you. Isn't it great to think someone might come to your
uh-huh.
aid and help you?
Uh-huh.
Just be it a flat tire, be it you haven't enough change, be it that you're homeless and you have a couple of quid to give to somebody, be it whatever it is, that you could just get someone out of that situation, and it costs very little or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And what Carmel did, I called her an earth angel, and I don't mean hocus pocus dancing around the full moon kind of stuff. I mean, can we not be that for each other, to be the decent person in a crowd that'll just say, here, look, I saw you fall, let me pick up your stuff, or someone's stuck at the shop or the parking meter or whatever it is, to just do something kind.
What did you call her, Breach?
An earth angel. Yeah, we're all walking around and we're good people. So can we look up to the heavens when things go wrong for ourselves, and we're asking God or whatever you believe in, or we're asking people to intervene for us, and you're thinking, well, I could intervene for someone else in a small way, in my small gesture. So we could be earth angels for each other, help each other out. Kind of like, it doesn't have to be big things. Why turn your, you know, what Carmel did to me was a big thing. I thought she was so brave. But she was right. That's the other side of it. She was helping someone.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do a little bit more of that for each other, don't we?
Well said, Breach. Thank you so much for getting in touch. I'm also very encouraged that you're saying, as you get older, and you're not old, by the way, you're getting tougher. You're not going to take anyone's nonsense today either. So well done to you as well.
I absolutely agree. I think it's because I let my hair go grey and I'm like, I don't care anymore.
Is that what it is? Is that your strength, is it?
I got a pixie hair
cut, and I let my hair go grey during lockdown. And everyone keeps telling me, "You look mighty," and I'm like, "I am mighty, and I'm going to stay mighty for as long as I can, and I'll help where I can." And sure, if we can all be a little bit more decent to one another, wouldn't the world be a nicer place?
Breed, was it a difficult decision to go grey or to stay grey? I'm grey myself, but I'm not going to do anything about it at this stage. I only wish I had more hair. Was it tough for you?
Not really. I think I kind of hit 50 and went, I don't care. I'm going to do stuff for me on my terms. And I thought, if you don't like it, you don't have to look at it. I like it. I'm going to get on with it. And I've saved a fortune in hairdressers. Sorry to all the hairdressers out there, but I've saved a fortune.
I bet you have. Saved a lot of hassle too as well. And grey can be very glamorous, can't it? Or am I just telling myself that?
No, it can. Absolutely. Absolutely. I would be the first to say, yes, you can be as glamorous as you want. As long as you're glamorous in your own head, it doesn't really matter what anyone else thinks.
Anyone else giving you strange questions or criticism about it?
No, the only thing that happened to me, but I think it's happened to other people and I'm okay with it now, but I did come out a bit shocked, and I'm saying it to my daughters, who are all young, fabulous young ladies, and I went into Woody's one day. I was buying something, I don't know what I was buying, and they asked me, they said I was entitled to the senior citizens discount. I was a very young member of staff.
Age, I don't even want to mention your age again, but I think you're about 50 here. They asked you, did you want the senior citizens discount?
I think they saw the grey hair and went, she's old.
Did you take it, Breed?
I did. I said, I absolutely do. Thanks very much. It paid for my cup of coffee on the drive home. It was great.
There are some types of discrimination that can work well for you out there.
Well, it's an ill wind.
There you go, Breed. Fair play to you. You were feeling even more mighty after that. Well done, Breed, and thanks so much.
Absolutely.
You're an inspiration to us as well.
Stay mighty, women. Stay mighty.
Stay mighty. Whether you're going grey or not, I'd love to hear listeners' thoughts on that. Liveline at rte.ie or 51551. Thanks very much to Breed. I also like that she said there, you never know what's going on in someone's day. You never know what's happening, because I was thinking about it with Claire and we were talking about miscarriage as well. We shouldn't jump to conclusions. We shouldn't assume things or ask awkward questions of people about having babies or not or things like that as well. Wise words there from everyone we spoke to. Maybe just stop and think for a minute before you speak or you ask. 51551 or liveline at rte.ie. Hi, Anita, how are you?
Hi, how are you, John?
I'm well, and yourself?
Good. We've just arrived at Centre Parks with the kids, so
They're
living their best life at the moment.
You're having a great time, so and I hope you do have a great time. There's great excitement in your car, I'd say, all day, is there?
Oh my God, yeah, the excitement was real.
Well, I hope you have a great time, but tell us why you got in touch, because what's happened in your area?
Yeah, so we are absolutely devastated. I live in a town called Arklow, and our Wicklow County Council have started this initiative by putting up communication boards, which are visual support tools for non-verbal children. And
I've seen them, like in the playground or things like that, is it?
Yeah, so they're mostly in playgrounds now to support families, and they've been put in some residential areas and community spaces, and they're just such a vital, vital tool for families across Arklow.
And
I had caught...
Anita, sorry, I was going to say I've seen them in the playgrounds where I live in Clare and other places as well, where we see signs and symbols on a board. Will you explain it to anyone who hasn't seen this these type of communications board in their public area?
Yeah, so we call them communication core boards. So my little boy has autism and he's also nonverbal and he can't communicate. So we rely heavily on visual aids and tools, and basically there are little photographs on them, and we use a lot of real photos. So if he wanted something to eat, he could point to hungry, then he can point to what food he wants, or if he wanted a drink, he could point to the drink picture, and it's his way to communicate, which helps me understand what he wants, and it gives him the opportunity to have the independence to request things. So this is what we do at home. So having communication boards in a playground is so like huge for us. So now he
and it's working for your children. Then this has been a good thing. It's something they've embraced.
Yeah. So now my son can go into the playground, and before we used to be like, do you want to go on the swing? Do you want to go on the slide? Like, where do you want to go? And he'd get quite frustrated because it'd take me a while to realise what he's trying to communicate to me. Now he just takes me by the hand, brings me over to the communication board and points, I want to go on the swing, mammy. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. And it just gives him that independence and confidence. Mm. And it gives me confidence as well.
Isn't that a great feeling, Anita, when he's able to tell you what he wants and you feel that you can give him what he wants, and communication is happening even if it's not happening the way you would have hoped for?
Yeah, and it reduces the anxiety as well, because I'd have a lot of anxiety bringing my son, because he would have quite a few behavioural issues, but it's down to frustration. It's down to not being able to express how he feels or what he wants. So these communication boards are just so vital for our families.
So what went wrong, Anita?
So we're absolutely devastated. So like I said, Wicklow County Council have been putting communication boards across our club. One of these communication boards were actually put up in a housing estate in a playground in Meadowvale. And a lot of my friends who would also go there with their kids, we were all just so delighted that it was there. And it's not even just the support. It was also kind of like a statement that our kids were accepted, they were included, you know, that they had a feeling of belonging. And we were all delighted. And we then came to our attention within a week of it being put up that it had been damaged first, which we were so upset about, and we were going to get it fixed. And then a few days later, it was completely destroyed. The pictures are completely torn off it. It's just basically a blackboard now. And I know some people might not understand value of these to us, or they might think, oh sure, it's just a board with pictures, but to us it's not just vandalism, it was almost like you're silencing our children, you've took away their voice, and we were just absolutely devastated.
I can tell you're upset by this. It sounds like senseless vandalism. We don't know what happened. Somebody maybe didn't understand what it was, maybe they thought they were messing about. They don't maybe realise the depth of what they've done here, Anita.
And I really think that's it, because like even when I'm part of a charity down here, Little Warriors, like all our parents, and we met and we chatted about it, and we all even said, you know what, yes, it's vandalism and it's a huge disrespect, and you know, but I do think it's the lack of education around these like support tools. And if anything that came from this, there's been such an outcry and social media presence, like media coverage on it, that it's actually opened up to conversation now to explain what these boards are and how important they are, and what an asset to all communities to have that, and given every child and adult in our neurodiverse community the opportunity to be heard. But I do think it's the lack of education, and I think we just need to be explaining to our kids and having these conversations that, you know what, these aren't just a board with a few photos on it, these are actual tools, vital tools to help everyone have their voice heard.
Can it be replaced? Will it be fixed?
We are hoping so. We're in talks with Wicklow County Council at the moment. So it was DISC, which is the Disability and Inclusion Steering Committee. So they were the ones that got the funding to put it up. So we're hoping that they will replace it. But we've been so lucky. We've got such a wonderful community in Arklow. Like, we really, really are blessed. So there's been a few businesses that have reached out to us, and they're like, look, we'd love to help fund to have it replaced. And it's been heartwarming in that sense for such a tragic thing, that so many people are coming together to support. So we're just waiting to hear back from Wicklow County Council when we can have this replaced, and I hope it's sooner rather than later.
Happen, but hopefully by spreading the word, people will know the importance of these as well, and maybe think twice as well before you go doing something you shouldn't as well. Anita, I'm going to let you go, because I'd say you have a busy day ahead of you there, and people dying to have fun there as well, so have a lovely time.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on as well.
You're very welcome. Anita, take care there. Have a lovely day there. Liveline at rte.ie or 087 484 8888.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
And 51551 for your text. Hello, Joan.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks very much for getting in touch with us on Liveline as well.
Yeah, I just had a funny little story in relation to going grey. I went grey in lockdown, but a few weeks ago I was in an Aldi store and I went through the self-service checkout area, but because I had bought a bottle of wine or something, one of the staff had to come over to take the tab off the bottle before I could pass out through the self-service area.
Yeah.
So she looked me dead straight in the eye with a very serious face and said, "Can I ask you please, are you over 18? So I just thought it was quite funny and I thanked her profusely.
Joan, I'd say you gave her a hug at that stage. Were you delighted?
I did. I was. Yeah, yeah.
It's the little things. I don't think anyone's asked me for ID for a long time now. I'd have loved it. Yeah. There was a time you used to get up in arms years ago if you were asked for ID in a shop or if you went to another country. And now what you wouldn't give for someone to mistake you for a younger age.
That's right, for an 18-year-old, exactly, yeah. So I just thought when you were talking about people going grey, I just thought it was a funny little story to tell you.
It's a lovely story. Thanks very much, Joan. And tell me about going grey, will you? Because what happened during lockdown?
Well, I just couldn't access the hairdresser and I just decided I'd go grey.
Right. And was it a big step for you? Did you have to colour your hair over the years?
I did. I've been colouring my hair, I'd say, since I was in my late 20s, possibly.
What colour?
So, I was kind of brown, blonde, you know, light brown, let's say.
You'd like to experiment with it a bit, did you?
Not really. It never varied too much, I suppose. But just when lockdown came then and I was looking at the grey hair, I thought I'll go with it.
Mm-hmm. And was it a hard decision then? Because I suppose for the first while your colour's growing out, is it? And you're sort of half grey and half something else.
Yeah, but at the time it wasn't a big thing because there was a lot of people going around with their grey roots showing. So there was no option if I, you know.
It became its own look, didn't it, for a while?
Yeah, it did. It did, yeah.
And of course, we didn't have many nice places to go out to.
Exactly. Yeah, you could get away with it.
And did people comment on it? Do they comment on it now, Joan? Or what kind of response did you get?
I don't think people comment on it now. Maybe in the beginning some people did, but I'd say I probably got positive complimentary comments on it, really.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Like that just my hair looked good and, you know, they didn't. I don't think people saw a big problem with it.
Mm-hmm. Did they say good for you? We heard people earlier on nearly feeling stronger because of going grey, they think.
And some people would say you were brave to go grey. They mightn't want to do the same thing, but I never felt it was anything other than just natural at the time. And
And Joan, your hairdresser did open up again, and I do want to support your local hairdresser as well. But does it mean you don't need to go there as much? Have you worked out how much money you might have spent on hair colour over the years?
I haven't worked that out. No, no. But I would still go to her regularly to get it cut. So.
Women are still, would you say, more reluctant to go grey? It's maybe some men too, I don't know.
I think they are. I think women are. I can't speak for men, but I think women are. Mm-hmm. Like I say, some people would say to me, "Oh, you were brave." They wouldn't want to go grey, perhaps. So
They couldn't. They just couldn't imagine it. Were you that person once upon a time, Joan?
Probably, yeah. But then once I decided I was going grey, I just kept going.
Okay, well, good for you. And lots of people are inspired by you. What advice would you give them? So give it a go, give it a try, or can you go back?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you probably could if you wanted to, but I wouldn't now. I'm quite happy with my hair, the colour it is.
Mm-hmm. Life is a bit simpler. And sure, if you're in the supermarket queue and they're asking you, are you over 18? You're not doing too badly.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Very good. Anyone ever mistake it the other way around, Joan? I hope not, because I suppose that's probably most of our reluctance, isn't it? The fear of ageing or someone saying something we don't
absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely. But your ageing is a privilege.
Quite right. Do you think we get it wrong sometimes when we're all afraid of it or trying to stay young?
I think so. Mm-hmm. It's a privilege that's denied to many, so just let's embrace it.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point. Well said, Joan. Thank you very much. I suppose many people mightn't be as brave as you on it, but it's a good point. Ageing is a privilege. Yeah. And long may those compliments keep coming, Joan.
Thank you.
Joan, thank you very much for talking to us there in Enniscorthy as well. liveline@rte.ie if you want to get in touch with us on these or other issues. I didn't think anyone would be calling me for hair tips. They're not really. They didn't have any advice to me on how to straighten mine out. But Brendan Courtney's coming up next, so maybe he'll be able to help you out with the style tips as well. No better man. It's liveline@rte.ie and 0818715815. Thanks to so many of you for getting in touch with so many interesting stories as well today. I look forward to your company again tomorrow. The programme was produced by Rachel Graham. James Feeney was on sound and Laura Lee Davies is our broadcast coordinator. Thanks to so many of you for getting in touch. For me, John Cook, and all the Liveline team, have a lovely afternoon.